Okay, well, good morning, everyone. Great to see you, and glad you are here to talk about something that is important to certainly all of us, the Everglades. As Marjorie Stoneman Douglas said famously, there is only one Everglades, and I think for us, for Congress, for everyone, is how to keep it. My name is Michael Putney. I'm a political reporter at Channel 10 here in Miami-Fort Lauderdale. I am not an environmental reporter, but in the course of being a reporter in South Florida for 35 years, I have done a heck of a lot of environmental studies stories, I have some great memories of those stories. I mean, maybe I first got to know them. I'll just say a few words before we hear from the panel. When I came here in 1977, almost immediately, I went out on a outward bound trip. And we went down to Flamingo. Then we were put ashore after we had rowed these boats endlessly for 7 or 8 days. And they put me down on Cape Sable for 3 days without food, and you're sitting there and you're looking at the sand and the Everglades and the birds and the water, and you're very quiet. And I think that whatever connection I have with the Everglades began during those 3 days. I'll tell you a little funny story. The leader of our trip said, as he put me ashore, he said, "Now there are going to be some storms coming through here, and if they're lightning storms, you really have to be careful." He said, "If the lightning comes right around you, get down on the beach in a little ball, curl up as tight as you can, and then kiss your ass goodbye." Fortunately, I'm still here, obviously. I know I'm looking at some faces that I know are dedicated to the Everglades, and so you have been out there. If you are from out of town and you have not had a chance to be there, to spend a little time, I just cannot urge you strongly enough to take a morning, take an afternoon, go to the Shark River Valley. I happen to say, as corny as it is, go out and get on one of the Indian airboats. And it seems like a very touristy thing to do, and indeed it is, but it is quite wonderful. I know that when I came here, I had never seen the Everglades. I'd been to all kinds of national parks, and it took me a while to begin to apprehend the mystery and the beauty of the Everglades. But our subject this morning is, where does restoration stand? And we have quite a remarkable panel here. I have to say I'm very disappointed that we do not, as hard as we tried, to have anybody from the agricultural interest or the sugar interest. We invited Pepe Van Hool. Very sorry that Mr. Van Hool could not fit this in. We had also invited former Governor Charlie Crist, who for a period at least seemed to be a great advocate of Everglades restoration. I don't know. We'll hear from Kirk and Shannon Dexter about that perhaps. But Charlie obviously is not here either. So I'm going to ask our panelists to introduce themselves and for a couple of minutes talk about what their interests are in the Everglades and the restoration process. And then after they have made their comments, I may ask them a few questions, and then we're going to open it up for you to ask questions. So first, let me introduce Shannon Estenos from the U.S. Department of the Interior. Shannon?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael. And let me say, first of all, that what an honor it is actually to be sitting here at a table. I'm actually a very big fan of Michael Putney's. I think he is a tremendous asset to this community, and I've followed your work for a long time. It's really wonderful to be here. Good morning. I have actually Pepe and Charlie's name tag, so if we get bored throughout the morning, I thought I would just sort of replace it and be Shannon for a while, and then I'll be Pepe, and then I'll be a governor. My name is Shannon Estenose. I'm currently the Director of Everglades Restoration Initiatives with the U.S. Department of the Interior. Prior to that, I was a member of the governing board of the South Florida Water Management District. I served a term as the vice chair of that board. And prior to that, I spent most of my career in the NGO community as the Everglades Director for World Wildlife Fund. I was a regional director for National Parks Conservation Association. And I started my career as the executive director of my husband's fledgling law firm in the mid-90s, the Everglades Law Center. The Department of the Interior is a key participant and player in the Everglades restoration effort. Our equities in the Everglades are significant. We have 4 national park units, 16 national wildlife refuges. We also, of course, in our Fish and Wildlife Service Bureau has trust responsibilities over endangered federally listed species. I know this thing is, you know what? Why don't I do this? It's a high-tech fix there. There we go. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has trust responsibilities over federally listed species as well. And of course, the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, which is another one of our bureaus, has significant science programs in the Everglades. So Interior has quite a large presence here, and our trust resources depend heavily, the survival of them depend heavily on the success of Everglades restoration. I know we're going to talk about this, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time, on sort of my opinion about kind of where restoration is at the present time. I will say that I think, at the risk of sounding, I think you could say this. There's not a time in the last decade that somebody couldn't plausibly say this, but I do think we are at a really pivotal point in time in Everglades restoration, because with an effort like this, what we do when resources are very scarce matters a lot. I mean, it's one thing to do decision making when resources are plenty. I'm finding another thing to do decision making when resources are very constricted and scarce. And that's sort of the state of play nowadays. And it really, it's really challenging us to focus and to prioritize and to pay attention to the things that are, it's really important to do next. We have a first generation of restoration projects that are under construction, and in the case of Picayune Strand, I think receiving already producing some benefits. We have a second generation of projects that are complete in their planning and are getting ready to be sent up to Congress for authorization. And so the question before us is, what does the third generation of projects look like? And what do we do next? What does the next decade of Everglades restoration look like? And, for us at Interior, we feel pretty strongly that we really need to turn our resources and attention to the central and southern Everglades and restore those habitats in the water conservation areas that suffer from dirty water, from too much water, from ponding water, tree island habitats and the like. Restore habitat in Everglades National Park that suffers from too little water, dirty water, and mistimed flows of water. We have done a tremendous amount of work, and I'll close with this and pass it off to Kirk. Over the last 10 years, our resources have been focused really along the edges of the Everglades, important, really important projects on the edges of the Everglades. I think it's time we turn our attention to the center and let the next 10 years of Everglades restoration be really defined by turning our attention to the river of grass itself. And so that's my hope for the future. I'll turn it over to Kirk. Oh, you've got a mic. Sorry. Okay.
Thank you, Michael, for hosting us today. I see a lot of familiar faces, but for those that I don't know yet, my name is Kirk Fordham. I'm the CEO of the Everglades Foundation. I'm not an environmentalist, but in my professional background, I spent most of my time on Capitol Hill as a chief of staff for a few different members of Congress, and some of them more famous than others. Most recent boss was Tom Reynolds from upstate New York, where I grew up in Rochester. Worked for Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, who was the only member of the U.S. Senate to vote against the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. And then my most famous boss outside of Mel Martinez was Mark Foley from West Palm Beach, who once represented the Big Sugar growing district. So I have a pretty unusual background for an environmental group that is committed to protecting the Everglades. The foundation was started back in the mid-90s by a group of businessmen and women who love to fish in Florida Bay, and they saw the Everglades collapsing with algae blooms and fish kills taking place in some of their favorite fishing holes. And so they hired a few scientists, and today the foundation is really a science-based organization that is committed to one mission, and that is the protection of and the restoration of what's left of the Everglades. And we do this not only because we think it's a spectacular natural treasure, but also because it really provides the lifeblood of the economy of most of Central and South Florida. Without water, this economy ceases to exist. We have industries from commercial and recreational fishing to tourism to real estate, a vibrant hunting community in this region that depends on a clean and healthy Everglades. So aside from the fact that it's a great place to visit, it also provides one in three Floridians with their water supply, and that's why we have made this our mission.
Before Dexter speaks, let me just say that Dexter, who I've known for 30 years, is a friend and was an outstanding United States attorney and provided me with a moment that I will never forget as a reporter. I forget exactly what year it was. Dexter will remind us, but he wrote a lawsuit suing the state of Florida over water quality. I'm being very general here. And the then governor of Florida, a truly great man in my estimation, Lawton Chiles, came to court with a vial of Everglades water. And he stood up. He was the defendant in the case. And he stood up and he said, the federal government is right. This water is dirty, and we're going to clean it up. It was one of those moments where you kind of reel back and say, things may change. Well, I think things did change. I'm not sure how much they changed, but in any event, for that and many other advocacy issues for the Everglades, Dexter, I salute you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're right, Michael. That was a good moment, and we appreciate what the governor did and Lieutenant Governor Buddy McKay, who yes. negotiated the settlements after that. Who, if I recall, was briefly governor, was he not, when when Lawton passed away prematurely toward the end of his term? One correction, which makes no substantive difference, but we actually brought the water to court.
Oh, you did.
And Lawton borrowed it after the argument.
Okay.
But I was United States attorney from 88 to 92. Prior to that, I served in the Florida House and Florida Senate on environmental committees, and I became convinced then and still am convinced that the problem in the Everglades really, and in a lot of environmental areas, is a failure to enforce existing law. It's not really that we need additional laws, although we do in implementing laws, but it's a lack of a political will on the part of enforcement agencies to enforce the law, interestingly enough, no matter what party is in office, whether it's a Democratic president or Republican president or Democratic governor or Republican governor. Bureaucratic politics and political pressures are such that it's always seen as impractical to actually require what the law says. That was the genesis of the 1988 Everglades lawsuit and the genesis of a lawsuit that is more important now that ended up falling in front of Judge Gold, local federal judge Alan Gold, on requiring the state's pollution laws to conform with and their NPDES surrogate permitting to conform with the requirements of the Clean Water Act, which has the only Gold is the only one enforcing any significant deadlines whatsoever today. When we have the comment period, I'll indicate. But just to foreshadow, I don't think it's money, though money is always an issue, and I don't think that it is creative lawmaking I think it's a failure. Somebody could do a PhD dissertation on the role of implementation of laws and why, for one reason or another, implementation of laws, are environmental laws, are often classified as impractical, and we need to go along in that regard. The federal judiciary is the only branch that's played any significant role in taking a different view, a kind of rule of law approach, which is what my approach. I do not represent any entity in the Everglades today except myself, but having grown up there and having been camped and fished in the Everglades as a kid, been bitten by poisonous snakes in the Everglades, and but I did represent an Indian tribe, and I did represent the U.S. government, as I indicated, for a while. Thank you.
Thanks, Dexter. Obviously, as we all know, the issue of enforcement of existing laws falls to both federal and state agencies. And let me ask you on the panel first about state enforcement. Shannon, don't mean to put you in a tough place as a department of the Department of the Interior, but, you know, here we have a governor now in the state of Florida. Let me back up a little bit. It was in this very hotel about 3 years ago that Charlie Crist, then the governor, had a environmental conference. Arnold Schwarzenegger came, gave a speech. A lot of notable environmentalists were here. And then it came, kind of fell off the radar, in my view. And now we have a governor who rails against regulation almost every single day. So, Shannon, again, maybe a little awkward, but what do you expect from the governor and this legislature in terms of enforcing regulations that the state can on Everglades restoration?
I, like all of us, am getting to know this governor, and he's very new, and it took a little bit of time to sort of put in place his Everglades team. What I can tell you is only sort of my own personal experience so far, and it's pretty short, you know, but my own personal experience so far is that certainly the team that the governor has put in place, folks like Melissa Meeker, who's the executive director of the Water Management District, and who I've known for a very long time, Herschel Vineyard, who's the secretary of DEP, who I've known for a very short period of time, and then he's got some other folks there. He's brought back a fellow named Greg Munson, who is his deputy assistant secretary, deputy secretary, and you know, this team is knowledgeable. This team has a tremendous amount of experience in the Everglades. He has not put folks in charge that have had to climb up a huge learning curve. I think Secretary Vineyard would say he's new to the Everglades, but the first thing Secretary Vineyard did was hire a bunch of experienced folks. And so that's been helpful in the dialogue between the state and federal government. It was widely reported a couple of weeks ago that the state of Florida did approach, the governor himself came to Washington, D.C. to meet with Secretary Salazar. And it was, I would characterize the conversation as a very frank one. He put a PowerPoint presentation up on the wall, and the PowerPoint presentation had, you know, numbers like 10 parts per billion on it. And it was a very... it wasn't a highly qualified conversation at all. He's put a couple of ideas on the table. The federal government is evaluating those ideas. I think we don't know the merits of them yet. But frankly, you know, over the last 6 or 7 months, it has been certainly an amiable conversation. It's been I think productive conversation. As short as it's been pretty positive. In terms of predicting, you know, where the administration will go, I don't think I can do that. But based on the last 6 months, it's been pretty positive.
Good.
Kirk, let me ask you to comment on this, too, and particularly the point Shannon raised earlier, which is the state budget in the state of Florida has gone from roughly $73 billion 4 years ago. Now it's down to about $68 billion, and it's probably going to be down another billion, which means this coming fiscal year, which means money is scarce all around. And when lawmakers are looking for areas to cut, unfortunately, environmental protection, regulation, purchase of endangered lands is generally at the top of the list.
Yeah, and I think if you looked at the governor's first 6 months and his environmental policies, I think many of us in the environmental community would have been pretty alarmed about the direction they were heading in. I think, though, that when the governor hit the bottom of the list of the most popular governors in the country, and he was number 50, and I think he recently moved up to number 49, there was a self-assessment that took place in Tallahassee, and I think he's replaced most of his senior staff in the governor's office, and he seems to have changed course, and we're open to conversions here, and I think for the remaining three-plus years that he has left, I think he has an opportunity to make the Everglades the centerpiece of his environmental policy platform. Now, as far as the budget goes, last year he proposed another cut down to $17 million, which is traditionally an amount that was up at $100 to $200 million under Jeb Bush's administration investments in Everglades restoration projects. I think that that number is going to move up this year in spite of the fact that the governor's got a smaller pot of money to work with. However, what the governor did do, and I think they're trying to find a way out of now, is they put handcuffs on the Southwater Water Management District's ability to raise the revenue to fix the water quality problem that has plagued this state for so many years now. I think they realize they may have overreached. They ratcheted back the amount of tax revenue they can raise from property owners in South Florida. And as a result, they've really limited their ability to implement some of the plans that need to be completed to fix this water quality problem over the longer term. I'm optimistic that the plan that the governor presented as an opening offer will be countered by the federal government with a more aggressive and stringent plan that is closer to the EPA amended determination. But the bottom line is they need to start doing something soon. We can't afford to wait several more years for the federal government and the state government to go back and forth and let the lawyers strangle the process here. We need to get projects moving with STAs being constructed on the land that the state already owns, and we need to insist upon source control at the same time. We need to insist that the sugar growers and other ag interests in the EAA start cleaning up the water more aggressively on their land before it moves into the taxpayer-subsidized stormwater treatment areas. So that's an opening observation, and I think this governor has the opportunity to make a mark, but the verdict is still out.
Dexter, give us your view on this subject, if you would. And in addition to the state, since Secretary Salazar has come to this conference, and we think, you know, most people here certainly know his record and think that he's a real advocate for Everglades restoration, why don't the feds enforce the existing laws, as you said?
Well, I have the good fortune to not be involved in these current discussions, and those that are have a legitimate need to be in the dialogue in good faith. So that frees me, for example, to point out that Governor Scott's PowerPoint in Washington, which is not inconsistent with the PowerPoint of virtually every governor and every EPA and so forth. There's nothing really different about Scott. But Governor Scott's PowerPoint asks to move the current deadline, he claims, from 2016 to 2022. And one of the interesting points is that when reporters cover the Everglades, they tend to take the last deadline as the base deadline. And, 6 years of a delay isn't too much. But that 2016 was moved from from 2012, 26. It was 2002 in the original consent decree. So what we should hold Governor Scott and the federal government, the Obama administration, to is even though they're the latest kids on the block and they weren't responsible for all of these earlier delays, institutionally they represent agencies and governments that are responsible for those delays. So I don't see a lot of hope in the current enforcement environment. It is true that money's short now, but money was not short in previous years, and we just diverted it to projects that didn't matter and did things that, didn't help the Central Everglades. We institutionally are really not able to follow a comprehensive plan because of bureaucratic politics, and every new person wants to get their name on a different project, and just enforcing the original comprehensive plan project doesn't get them any real political credit. So I don't know where we'll go in this environment where money is short, because in some ways Inhofe was right. We didn't have the capability of carrying out that comprehensive Everglades restoration plan, which I endorsed, which I liked, and most people did, when we had a lot of money. So it might be that the irony might be that the shortage of money and the inability to measure ourselves by the amount of last year's appropriations bill will be a good thing, because it will require us to go to fundamentals, to go to source controls, to go to spend the money on the most important project right now, not on, and I have a list in the back of the room, a little blue sheet of stories, I think, that were never written about the Everglades, you know, kind of like Sherlock Holmes, that famous clue, the dog that didn't bark, mm-hmm. something that an event that didn't happen. All of the failures along the way that have not been covered by the media, I think, and diversions of money created an atmosphere, especially of we're making progress if you appropriate money, and we're not making progress, and we don't track where the money goes. I mean, I'm not a reporter, and it's a tough business, I'm sure, with editors, and you got to sell the stuff, and you have limits of time and everything. I mean, I'm not explaining, I don't have a theory on how you would do it better, but I do know that the failure to track the money in the past has meant that the money hasn't gone where it should go. The generalized branding of people, like if the Park Service wants it, it's good, and if somebody else wants it, it's not good. The failure to actually look at the impact of projects on the ground might, again, to repeat myself, the irony might be that since we can't throw money at something anymore and call that progress, maybe we'll actually make some progress. Now, the Water Management District does need to raise some additional revenue. But I'm not one who thinks that voters are absolutely opposed to additional taxes. You know, we take that view. But when voters down here were voting against certain rapid transit in the same elections, they were voting for a tax increase for environmentally endangered lands. When they were mm-hmm. voting against in another election that rapid transit bond, they voted for a sales tax increase temporary for libraries. So the public, if it thinks that the issue is not additional money, is the public going to be convinced that the money is spent on something useful? And I, as an advocate of restoration from my viewpoint, believe that we have appropriated enough money in the past to have solved the problem. We just, I'm thinking of a cleanlier way to say it, we just allowed that money to be diverted and not used on proper proper things. And I do have a list in the back, that little blue sheet, but I won't go through that. So we might be entering a time when the governor will have to do some real regulatory enforcement, you know, because he just can't throw money at the problem. And then when what money we do throw at it will be spent more more effectively. And that will only happen, by the way, I'm sorry for taking the time, if Judge Gold holds himself. He's gone senior, but he's going to keep his cases. And I know this sounds very specific, like one guy, but yeah, one guy is the key to this. That's the Everglades Forever Act lawsuit that the Miccosukee tribe filed after environmental groups had conceded to Governor Bush to let him have that law. The tribe was the one that sued on it. And Gold says EPA's determinations are wrong, forced EPA to make a determination that the state was now in violation, is going to want to know why 2016 won't be met. He said the deadline is 2006, but it's in violation. And I've seen newspaper stories that say the deadline's 2016. So what's the problem with going to 2022? But Gold might be the key to this whole thing. Unfortunately, the other Everglades lawsuit is not of great significance anymore. The one I filed, it was for 22 years, but not now.
Yeah, I would say
I filed the Miccosukee one too, but I'm talking about the other one.
Judge Ellen Gold is one of my heroes. He is just a intellectually brilliant guy, and as Dexter, I think, would agree, when he issues an order and you read the order, you see his reasoning, and then it goes up to the 11th Circuit, and they get to rule on it.
Not to go out of sequence, but I want to say that about Gold. You know, I've disagreed with some things he's done, you know, non-environmental, just other things being in front of him. But everybody who's in front of him says, you know, whether he rules against me or for me, he rules. He writes down reasons. You get a chance to go to the 11th Circuit. You know, he gets himself reversed sometimes because he's an aggressive judge, but at least you're allowed, you get an order and you can go to the 11th, where, by the way, all of the parties in that case are now trying to get Gold overturned.
If I could, let me tell you a little story about a personal experience I had with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. This will lead to a question to Shannon. Here's the story. It was back in, I think, like 1992, 88, somewhere along there. A Jacksonville legislator named Steve Padgett was running for the Democratic nomination for governor. And one fine day, he chartered a plane, and he put Marjorie—I will call her Marjorie. I met her a number of times. Put Marjorie on the plane and himself and a reporter. And fortunately, the reporter was me, and I had a photographer. And we flew up to Lake Okeechobee. And we went out on a pier on Lake Okeechobee and put Marjorie in a wheelchair and wheeled her down the pier. And then Steve Padgett had a couple of agricultural interests there from around the lake. And he gave a speech in which he at one point said, "We've got to clean up this lake. They've got algae blooms. It's just, it's too central to the economy, to the ecology of this area. We must clean up Lake Okeechobee. And we can do that with the cattle ranchers up there and the dairy farmers there and the sugar farmers down there. We'll find a way to make this work, won't we, Marjorie?" And she looked at him and said, "No." It was not exactly what a politician wants to hear. So my question is, I know there are new plans now to buy some lands north of the lake and try to clean up the water flow. Describe what that initiative is, Shannon, and whether you think it, what it will do.
Thank you. Michael's referring to the Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge effort, which is it is an effort by the Fish and being led by the Fish and Wildlife Service under the Department of the Interior to establish 150,000 acres north of Lake Okeechobee, 50,000 acres ultimately in fee acquisition, and then another 100,000 acres of less than fee conservation easements and the like. And we're working very closely with USDA with their conservation easement programs to find new dollars. These would be, a lot of this would be new dollars flowing into the Everglades that are not flowing there necessarily now. And there are significant dollars available, at least for the time being, in USDA's conservation programs. And so the interest here is sort of how do we leverage those in the service of our environmental objectives in the Everglades, and in a way that is can be compatible with some of the upstream headwaters in terms of not just water quality, but also habitat protection and habitat corridors for species like the panther and others. And this is an initiative that has been moving for about 10 or 11 months now. We're in the middle of that process. We've got a document out for public comment. And the public's been incredibly engaged. And the landowners in particular, I think, are very keenly interested in seeing this initiative move forward. Secretary Salazar, generations of his family have been in cattle ranching. And so he has had a lot of experience in Colorado when he was in Colorado with working with the private sector and landowners to preserve large swaths of land using less than fee types of mechanisms. And we think that north of the lake, you still have large tracts of land that are in single ownership. So you still have families who own 10,000 acres, 15,000 acres north of the lake. By and large, and I don't know if any of you have spent a lot of time in the Kissimmee Valley or in north of the lake, but a lot of that land, the nature of cattle ranching is such that a lot of that land is kept in its sort of natural state. And so cattle ranching in many ways is one of the land uses that is maybe the most compatible with a restored Everglades. And so the business reality of cattle ranching in Florida, though, folks, is that what we do in Florida, we are, as I understand, we are, I think, the third largest cattle producing state in the country, as I think is where our, please don't quote me on that. I'm always, you know, I've got a whole room full of media, but we're close to that. But what we do is we do cow-calf operations here. And so what happens is the ranchers will grow a calf until it gets to be about 500 or 600 pounds, and then they ship the calves out to the grain, out west to the big feedlots. And the economics of that are that the cattle ranchers really are kind of at the mercy of the price that's set by the feedlots. And so, you know, if you're a cattle rancher, you're sitting on a big land asset, and maybe your profit margins are pretty small. And once you get into the third or fourth generation, you know, maybe you have three or four kids who two of them don't really want to ranch anymore. They're a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. And so keeping those land assets together is a challenge, and certainly a huge challenge when real estate prices are high. And so this is an opportunity. I think this initiative is an opportunity to really work closely with those landowners who really, really want those land assets to stay intact. And I think you've got a tremendous ethic up in among a number of landowners north of the lake who don't want to see that acreage when the market rebounds. They don't want to see those lands turned into suburbs. And so this is a really terrific opportunity. We should seize it now and find that common ground and try to preserve, like I said, 150,000 acres of land in the headwaters. Sorry.
One more question, and then it's going to be your questions. Talking about great opportunities, maybe the boldest plan that I know of in the 3.5 decades I've been a reporter here to try to create a real water flow north to south through the Everglades was when Governor Crist made a deal with U.S. Sugar to buy, initially was going to be a huge purchase of land. It, for a variety of reasons, it got cut back. So, Kirk, tell us, where does that purchase stand, and is it big enough at this point to be the kind of radical solution that at least Governor Crist said it would be?
Well, the plan as it was originally envisioned was to buy out an entire U.S. Company. It was U.S. Sugar Corporation and 180,000 acres of their land and all of their assets. Shortly after the announcement, the world economy collapsed, the state's finances plummeted, and that bold initiative quickly shrunk to what, in the end, was a purchase of about 27,000 acres of land in the EAA, and then another 10 years an option for 10 years to buy additional land from the company for restoration purposes. Now, we can argue about the components of that actual transaction, the deal, whether the company's lease rates were fair or that the lease back period of time is too long. But the bottom line is that the vision that the governor outlined was that you need to bring land out of production in the AA to store and treat water before it moves into the Everglades. So we saw that as an opportunity to do what was impossible to do for many years prior. We had in the original Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan this sort of cockamamie idea that we could build about 250 underground storage wells and pump billions of gallons of water underground and then pull it out of the aquifer with very energy-intensive, very costly pumps. And the only reason they designed it that way was because Sugar wouldn't sell their land. You had no willing seller. So when you finally had a company that was willing to give up some of their land, it changed the whole equation. Now, did we agree with every component of the actual deal that was struck by the state and U.S. Sugar? Absolutely not. But what we did agree with was the vision and the understanding that it makes a whole lot more sense and it's much more cost-effective to store water on the land rather than building these very expensive underground storage and recovery wells. Now, what happened last year? The state closed on 27,000 acres of land. If you look at the governor's plan that he proposed a few weeks ago, they proposed basically, you look closely, they propose swapping some of the land that they bought from U.S. Sugar with land that is currently held by Florida Crystals, the Von Hull family, and a few other landowners in that area to expand treatment marshes adjacent to the Loxahatchee Wildlife Refuge. On the other portion of the land, the citrus groves that they purchased, there's some debate about whether or not they're going to use that for treatment areas for expanded STAs or if they're going to turn that into wildlife habitat restoration. In the end, everyone agrees now that you need more land to store and treat water, but the debate was really soured, I think, to a certain extent because you had a competing landowner in the Von Hulls that weren't part of that deal and part of the negotiations, and I think in hindsight the governor should have brought all the parties to the table, negotiated a comprehensive plan that involved swaps and trades so that we could spin off all the land that wasn't needed by the state. We don't need all of that land that U.S. Sugar owns. We need a certain portion of it.
That's why it was viewed by some, anyway, as a sweetheart deal for U.S. Sugar, because the Von Hulls and Florida Crystals were excluded, at least initially. All right, so how about your questions? Direct them to the panel in general or one person in particular, and give us your name and your affiliation. And the lady, yes, in green, go ahead.
Well, I think right now the state is talking to them, I hope, about how they fit into this picture of expanding stormwater treatment areas in the AA. I think the governor certainly has made it a priority to include all the parties, all the stakeholders in the process. One thing I do know is that right now we have enough land to build projects and move restoration forward. I think one of the most exciting things that we're hearing may happen soon is the notion of refocusing dollars and project spending on the central Everglades. If you look at where the SERP projects have been constructed, Dexter referenced this earlier, we invested a lot of money in projects which have great value to their respective regions. If you look at Picayune Strand, it's a tremendous opportunity in southwest Florida. The C-111 canal is going to provide benefits to Florida Bay and the park. The Site One project in Broward and Palm Beach counties is a water supply project for the East Coast. But they're all disconnected. None of them interlock and provide benefits to the core central Everglades corridor. So I think what we're hoping will come out of the next generation of projects is a focus on projects and treatment areas that will really provide the most lift and the most benefits to the core central Everglades connection from Lake Okeechobee down to the park itself. And I think that's where Dexter has pretty forcefully argued that the dollars, although those projects may have tremendous value in their respective regions, they're not connected and they don't provide the core Everglades with the kind of benefit that we're looking for.
Dexter, did you want to make a comment on that?
Well, I agree with what Kirk is saying, and I do think that there was a valid vision with regard to the sugar purchase, but I don't know, as a guy who fought in a war that had honestly a valid vision, the Vietnam War. I mean, communists, they killed people, they destroyed people. I mean, Stalin and Mao and Ho Chi Minh were destructive of human values. But we never got beyond that vision to whether or not we could make something happen on the ground in Vietnam. And it turned out to be a tragic war because we let our vision overwhelm our practical sense. And, you know, what majors and captains were saying to us on the ground, we were ignoring. Well, that's what the sugar purchase amounted to, a valid vision that got in the way of actually carrying out restoration projects. Its actual effect on the ground was the abandonment of the Everglades Agricultural Reservoir that was part of the long-term comprehensive planning. As Kirk pointed out, we still don't know exactly what we'd do with that land and so forth. It's not, by the way, that these other projects, which are valid, or anytime you can purchase additional land, which is a valid thing, it's a question of opportunity cost. It's a question of the marginal value of the money spent at the moment. It's not that buying that 27,000 acres was a waste of public money. It had a positive incremental effect. The question was whether the incremental value of one expenditure outweighs the incremental value of another expenditure. And the problem really is that if we finally get around to doing the Central Everglades, like we now use the EAA reservoir, the empty cesspool that it is, to be an STA, we'll get that STA after the phosphorus incursion on the Everglades has increased such that it's hard to reverse. The findings of scientists are we've never reversed the phosphorus intrusion, you know, where it exists. So you wait 10 years and you get a better use of that land 10 years from now or 5 years from now than you would have had we done it 3 years ago the way the comp plan called for. Actually turns out to be a worse use of the land because of the timing issue, you know. And not to overdo it, but in the Vietnam War, we finally got 80% of the peasants owning their own land in Vietnam from being like 10% of them. The 90% were absent, you know, paying absentee landlords, and they wanted land reform. But by time we did that land reform and the peasants were on our side, it was too late in the war. It turned into a conventional battle. I'm just afraid that the perfect, like the land acquisition and the better use of the EAA reservoir as an STA instead of a reservoir done 2-3 years ago, the perfect will come along too late as opposed to the imperfect that would have stopped some of the phosphorus early on. And let me just add this. You know, I think it seemed like it was relevant, but you know that the irony, this lack of money and the regulatory enforcement. You know, pollution control is a very conservative principle. Milton Friedman said you need to make producers internalize their cost of production. That's a conservative economic principle. You can talk Governor Scott into pollution controls as a conservative value. What's a liberal value are letting people pollute and then building public works projects with tax money to clean up their pollution. That's a liberal approach, which is very, you know, crony capitalism or crony socialism. Now, there's a mixture there because when you get to a district like the South Florida Water Management District, although it's public, it built a flood control project. And I think its taxes really amount to internalizing the cost of production, even though it's done as a government agency. It's really causing the people who are benefiting from the project, you know, to pay the way. That's a conservative argument, which is what I always said to the critics in my I'm not really party identified exactly, but you know, you generally register with a party in order to, you know, vote in the primary. And that's what I always said to Republican colleagues, which is why President Bush won. When they inquired as to what I was doing, and I explained to Alec Cortellis, who was a developer, what we were doing, because he said, you're getting a lot of criticism on this Everglades thing. He said, fine, I can't build. In the old days, we used to build shopping centers and just let the water run into Biscayne Bay. And now we have to, you know, we have to have controls on the water coming off of the parking lots of that oil. And that's a good thing. He said, except that when we were building malls, if you didn't have to do that, you'd not be cost competitive. I mean, if the other guy could build a mall without doing that pollution control and you tried to do it, you're not cost competitive. So he saw it as a real conservative. He was Bush One's national finance chairman. So it's really a conservative principle. And maybe we should sneak in the tail end and say, by the way, we need some money too. But you scare a lot of conservatives when you go in and you say to begin with, I need all this money. Because the answer they're going to give is, well, why? You know, why and how are you going to spend it and so on like that. So I think you need to pitch it as a conservative and regulatory. And then, oh, and by the way, in order to do this, we need a couple of $1 billion.
I just add to that real quickly. I'll be very brief. But, you know, the industry folks, the sugar industry, have masterfully rigged the system so that the taxpayers largely carry the burden of their cleanup costs. I mean, look, in Washington, they have a very ingenious subsidy program. It's a price support system that transfers $4 billion from consumers into their pockets. We then have in Florida, the state taxpayers basically pay for their flood control and irrigation system. And then on top of that, we pay billions of dollars to clean up the pollution before it flows into our natural resources. So they have masterfully externalized their costs. And that's something that I think Governor Scott, if he's listening to groups like the Cato Institute or the American Enterprises Institute or the Heritage Foundation, they've all pointed out the injustice of the sugar program and the fact that it completely distorts our free market system to the advantage of a very, very small people, of very wealthy families. So I think that warrants a very close look, and I've brought that to the attention of the governor's new staff, and I hope that resonates, because if he wants to protect the taxpayers, he might want to look at what BP was asked to do to clean up their mess in the Gulf. They paid 100% of the cost of cleanup plus economic damages. That's certainly not the case with the sugar industry.
Oh, I wish Mr. Feinhuhl were here today. The reporter from...
Shannon has hurt him a lot. She stand in.
His feelings would be hurt. The lady from the Palm Beach Post. Hi.
This working for the government thing is a new thing for me. Well, I'm probably not the right person to answer this. I mean, I work for the Department of the Interior, not the EPA. And so but I mean, the thing is that the I'm not an expert in the Clean Water Act, okay? And so I need to say that right off the bat. My understanding is that federal government is its ability to regulate things or require things like source control is somewhat limited. Actually, Dexter probably knows a lot more about this than I do. But perhaps the perspective from the governor is, you know, I think what the sense that I'm getting is they're focused on an effluent limit, a number at the end at the outflow of the STA or this treatment system. And they're making kind of internal decisions about how to get to that number. And, you know, so I think Kirk can maybe comment a little bit better on the merits of the ways you get to that number than I can. And certainly if EPA were sitting here, maybe they'd be able to express an opinion. But I think the sense that I'm getting from Governor Scott's administration is that you, the federal government, set an effluent limit. You know, we've got an effluent limit in the Clean Water Act, and it's up to us. I mean, I think I don't want to put words in their mouths, but the way I'm translating it is sort of it's up to us to figure out how to get there. The merits of their path that they've chosen is a conversation that I think, you know, is perhaps worth having. But from the federal perspective, that's what's been brought to us.
Well, look, our scientists are still checking all the models and evaluating the plan. We just got the data about a week ago, so it's premature for us to really judge whether the governor's plan meets that test. But, you know, I think on the surface, it's probably unlikely to get there, and there's going to need to be revisions in that plan. But again, we are not looking for years more in delays in conversations between the state and federal government, because that's what's gotten us to the point we are today. They need to start building and expanding STAs, and they need to demand that the ag folks remove pollution or at least hold the water on their land before it moves into our resources. We're sort of growing weary of the delays and the date extensions on these plans. I mean, one plan after another comes, and as Dexter said, they all look largely the same. You may move the STA from here to there, or you may have a reservoir here versus there on someone else's land. But the bottom line is we need to get projects moving forward, and they've got money in the bank. The district is sitting on several hundred million dollars right now. They could start construction tomorrow if they wanted to.
Go ahead, Shannon.
Well, I just wanted to make one quick point about sort of Dexter's good point about the perfect being the enemy of the good. And I want to just clarify, nothing that Dexter said I disagree with at all or what, you know, not at all. And his sense of urgency and the urgency that Kirk is expressing right now to get to construction is one that we all share, everyone involved in Everglades Restoration shares. I just want to put just a quick technical clarification on this question of the A1 reservoir, the reservoir that was stopped, the construction of the reservoir that was stopped. And I want to make it very clear that the plan that put a reservoir at A1, I would argue from a technical perspective, was not even good. It was less than good. And if you can go to the National Academy of Sciences' own maps, and you can see that had we built a $700 million reservoir, by the way, okay, a $700 million reservoir at A1, we would not have had the land to treat the water to send it south. That was the big flaw in using that piece of land as storage. And what would have happened is we may have, you're right, I mean, I think we could have stopped the flow of water south, but, you know, in my technical estimation, the Everglades, both the Central Everglades and the Southern Everglades, need more clean water. So they need both more water and clean water, and they need the water to move so that it doesn't pond up at the southern end of 3A. So at Water Conservation Area 3A. So I want to make it clear that SERP, 50,000 acres of Talisman, was not enough in the EAA. And we had to get more land for treatment. And to build a $700 million reservoir there was not a good plan. So it's not the perfect being the enemy of the good. I think it's the good being the enemy of the inadequate, essentially. So.
Could I just mention also, thank you for that. I do think that the point for journalists would be that the debate that, really not a debate, but the discussion that in a sense Shannon and I had here really wasn't covered very much in the media. That's the interesting point to me. Not so much who's right and who's wrong, because you guys, I guess, aren't really supposed to care who's right and who's wrong, but the nature of the coverage. But let me, add one other thing about source controls. You know, being a guy who said this was a conservative principle, pollution control, a guy who would like to not, who wished these federal environmental laws were not sometimes read as wiping out common law nuisance, because common law nuisance is a very powerful way to go after polluters. But I will say this, that though I'm an advocate of source controls and so forth, it is documented, I think you guys would agree or correct me, that there's such an amount of phosphorus in Lake Okeechobee today that we need source controls both for equity and to reduce the input, but source controls alone can't possibly do it given the amount of phosphorus that's sitting there in the lake. That's the real time bomb. So after you give, that's why I said you give a pitch to conservatives, the Cato kind of guys and so forth. I don't know them personally, but they're not like social conservative types. You know, it's not abortion or whatever. This is fiscal responsibility kind of thinking. You make that whole pitch, and then in the end you say, oh, and by the way, because we didn't enforce proper conservative Milton Friedman economic principles for the last 70 years, we do have to go in with a public work project, so we need that $2 billion. Because of our failure to follow conservative principles in the past, give us $2 billion to fix it, or some number like that.
Okay.
That's the way to pitch the money. That also demonstrates that you're not asking for this forever.
Yeah.
That you're just trying to fix a prior regulatory failure, and in the future, you're not going to be coming back for more money because you continue to let people pollute. Sugar, by the way, being a polluter, but as most of you know, governmental entities, municipal stormwater treatment systems and so forth, have a lot of clout on the Hill, and they're just as bad in many ways. I mean, we use sugar as a surrogate, but I do think that if you pile on sugar, being a private sector entity, you can make sugar conform. It's a lot harder to pile on government polluters and make them conform because they yell about their taxpayers and so forth. I don't know if anybody else has a comment on that, but I find government just as abusive or more than local government, more than sugar, because you can just beat them about the head and shoulders and make them conform if you got the political will. Sugar, anyway.
Well, as a governmental reporter, I would philosophically agree with you. This young lady has a question.
Well, I don't know specifically. What I know is that I've heard the same thing, and I know that it seems to me, as now an observer of the Water Management District, that the Water Management District seems to be focused on doing some of the basin types of projects for the Coosahatchee Estuary. The Coosahatchee has two problems. It has a wet season problem and a dry season problem. And the wet season problem is when the Corps of Engineers has to empty Lake Okeechobee because of the integrity of the dike as waters rise. And the only real solution to the wet season problem in the Coosahatchee Estuary is to take the water that's currently in the lake, clean it up, and send it south, or keep it in the lake, one of the two. And we have a Herbert Hoover dike that is the integrity of which is not going to be fixed for another at least decade and a half. And so keeping it in the lake is a very limited option. And so right now. So the efforts that I think Commissioner Judah was exploring are those within the basin types of projects that are really designed, I think, to attacking the dry season problem, which is the fact that in the dry season, Coosahatchee doesn't get any water, essentially. So, yes, I understand they've invested recently like $10 million in those kinds of projects.
I guess I would just say that those projects are tourniquets, the ones that you referenced there. The heart of Everglades restoration, the thing that will provide true benefits to the Everglades and the estuaries, is the ability to move water from Lake Okeechobee south into the Everglades and it be first treated and cleaned up before it moves south. So that's why we've always focused on that core central Everglades project. That's the heart. These other projects are sort of tourniquet-type fixes. And that's why I'm hopeful that the Army Corps of Engineers and the state will work together on a planning process that will focus on those core projects that are going to provide benefits to everyone.
How about one last question? Yes, please.
Yeah.
Can you recommend any resources for catching up, getting up to speed?
We have a briefing book at the Everglades Foundation, which has a glossary of terms. It has a history. It's sort of like, I would say, probably one of your best sources. Pardon me? Michael Grunwald's book.
Yeah, I was going to say
nice
The Swamp by Michael Grunwald,
one
in my
opinion,
view, is a brilliant summary of the history, basically, of Florida and of the Everglades over the last, 100 years or so. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, it's good, and it kind of reads like a novel, so it's an easy airplane read or whatever. And then there are a number of websites. The problem, though, I will tell you this, that the problem is that we don't have there's EvergladesPlan.org, for example. You could go there and spend 3 months and still not feel like you've caught up. So we need to do a better job. And Department of Interior, in the form of the South Florida Ecosystem Restoration Task Force, we are taking this on to create a new, a much more user-friendly interface for folks like you who don't have any background at all in the Everglades to be able to come in and become at least proficient, if not fluent, in Everglades ease. Which a lot of people in this room speak fluently.
The first and greatest fact that one could use and is constantly ignored is that most of the remaining Everglades is not in Everglades National Park. For some reason or another, the title Everglades National Park brands it as the Everglades, and only about a third of it is freshwater Everglades, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. The others are worth saving. A third of its estuary, a third of it is the surface of Florida Bay. All of that's worth saving. But when it comes to saving the Everglades, you have got to save more than just the park. In fact, you need to save a majority more. A majority of what you have to save is not in the park. That would be the first little bit of information that would be incredibly useful, that would keep reporters from constantly going to Everglades National Park for comment.
Yeah, and I would also point out that, you know, the Everglades, greater Everglades ecosystem runs from basically the Orlando suburbs all the way down to the Florida Keys. Mm-hmm. And there is a spectacular swath of land that runs up the western Everglades from, you know, the Naples area, the big Cypress region, all the way up through Glades, Henry County Highlands, up to the Everglades Headwaters Refuge. And what is being proposed is a collection of wildlife refuges that really saves that last swath of one of the most spectacular places in Florida. It's an amazing landscape. And there's proposed several wildlife refuges that would sort of form a string, a necklace of spectacular landscapes along that stretch. Unfortunately, right now, I think some of our colleagues in the environmental community have filed a lawsuit in recent weeks that really threatens the assembly of those wildlife refuges, because there's this sentiment in some quarters that hunters and, you know, traditional users of those refuges have no place in those areas, that we're trying to shut it off to human activity. And because of, I think, some misguided legal actions, those opportunities may be threatened. So I'd be happy to talk to you about that afterwards. But I think the important things, we want to protect the core Everglades through the central swath, and then we also want to protect this amazing wildlife habitat that stretches from south of Orlando all the way down to Naples.
That's a good point on which to end. I want to thank our excellent panelists, and thank you, and have a great conference.
Thank you very much.